You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places and pelicans of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. At the International Bird Rescue in San Pedro, a volunteer grabs a California brown pelican from a dog carrier and takes it over to an examination table.
Okay, you and I. Just you and I. Come on out.
This facility cares for aquatic birds, and it's been as busy here as it's been in a decade. A little more than a week ago, staff and volunteers here started seeing a huge influx of sick and injured brown pelicans. Between May 12th and just last Sunday, so a span of about 2.5 weeks, the San Pedro facility took in 200 pelicans. That's on the upper end of what the LA and its sister San Francisco rescue would take in an average year. And they don't know why.
So far, the animals that have had postmortem examinations appear to just be starving animals. They don't particularly have any signs of disease.
That's Rebecca Dewar, the veterinarian at the International Bird Rescue. She says they still aren't sure what's going on and why it happened so suddenly. And that's why reporter Susan Vallett stopped by the rescue to check it out.
Let's go. Pardon the smell.
Right, at least mask. Good for that, right? Yeah, sort of.
The fish stench cuts through your mask. The smell of herring and smelt hangs thick in the air, like the pall of smoke in a 1960s Vegas casino. Everyone wears masks here because they can't afford to have anyone go out sick now. The intake room to the right is filled with large moving boxes, each folded closed on the top. Inside each box, a brown pelican, sometimes bopping the top to try to get out.
Arm full of bird. Two arms full.
Volunteer Diane Carter fishes a pelican out of the sea of boxes to take it over to the table to be examined. This is the first stop to recovery. Carter covers the pelican with a sheet and holds it as a staff member takes its rectal temperature and attaches temporary numbered bands, similar to the kind you get at a concert.
We're just banding and tapping and triaging to the right spot.
The 9 pelicans in these boxes come from a facility in Santa Barbara that didn't have any more room for them. This rescue and its sister facility in San Francisco usually get about 100 to 200 brown pelicans combined in 1 year, not in a matter of days. The influx hasn't let up. Some pelicans have been found dead on the beach. Veterinarian Rebecca Dewar says for reasons they're not sure of yet, the problem is focused mostly on Southern California.
California Fish and Wildlife has been paying attention to what's going on with pelicans elsewhere in the state. And San Diego, Orange, Monterey are seeing increased numbers, but nothing like what we're seeing in our more local area.
Meaning L.A., Ventura, and Santa Barbara counties. Dewar says sometimes animal control brings in the sick pelicans, but other times people grab them from the beach and bring them in on their own, lice and all.
They're allowing people to approach, not flying away. They might just be hunkered down on the beach looking pathetic. You know, allowing dogs to come up to them, that sort of thing. A normal bird will stand up and look at you and then fly off.
And Dewar says if a pelican is starving, it's hard to tell other than by behavior. It doesn't look skinny.
Pelicans are big birds. They're like, 7-foot wingspan. But even though they're really a large bird size-wise, they don't weigh all that much. Like, they really only weigh about the same amount as a heavy cat because a lot of the inside of their body is air. They're very buoyant birds, and their skin is structured kind of like bubble wrap.
Dewar says pelicans use that air-filled buoyancy like a floaty, letting them dive for fish and quickly surface.
When they're emaciated, they're even more like that. Those of us who handle them regularly, we can tell just by picking one up. It's like, whoa, you weigh nothing. Kind of like the difference between, a solid rock versus a foam shape the same size.
And that's what's showing up at the rescue now, which can take on about 300 pelicans at a time.
Take a look at his foot welts right here.
Alrighty.
Most of the pelicans here are at least 1 year old, and about 40% are mature enough to breed. That means these aren't babies who don't know how to fish. These are birds that have survived in the wild on their own for a while.
What that suggests to us is that there seems to be a problem with them finding food, but nobody really knows why yet at this point.
And Dewar thinks that might be why a lot of these birds are also coming in entangled in fish hooks and fishing lines. They're trying to go where the food is, and that means scoping out areas where people are fishing off piers.
They can become entangled in a lot of the little tiny bait fish hook rigs that people use. One of these birds had 12 hooks on the outside of her body. So we are treating some pretty significant fishing line injuries. The pelicans are having trouble finding food right now, and they don't have any choices for other things to eat. So please do not cast your line into where they are feeding.
This isn't the first time the brown pelican has been in trouble in California. It was on the federal endangered species list for decades, plagued by problems caused by the pesticide DDT buried in the channel off our coast. The California brown pelican was taken off the endangered species list in 2009, and then the next year was hit by a similar wave of sick birds, and then again in 2012. Each of those lasted a few months. For now, the sick or injured pelicans are brought in and are triaged. They're weighed and tagged. Then the ones doing pretty good are put as groups into two large camping tents in a room. Volunteers and workers can then fish them out to check them out more closely.
All right, let's start with you. Post up.
That's a pelican nipping at my microphone. From here, the ones in worse shape are sent to an intensive care sort of area that's kept warmer and where they're watched more closely.
And then if the birds are not self-feeding, we'll actually make a little fish milkshake for them.
That's Kylie Clutterbuck, the manager of this facility. She says they make their way through a series of rooms over a course of days based on how they're doing.
So once they have been inside for a couple days and we're confident that they're self-feeding and they're gaining weight, we take them out to one of our aviaries.
The aviary we're standing in is filled with brown pelicans, a white pelican, and a random gull who's recovering from an injury. They're hanging out by a big above-ground pool. The pelican beaks clack together as they preen themselves. This is one of three similar enclosures here.
I'd probably say we have about 50 in here at this time.
Wow.
Yeah.
And normally this time of year, wouldn't look like this?
Yeah, a week ago we had three.
Workers fill bins with fish and the pelicans wait until they move out of the way before they drop down from the raised pool to devour the snack like famished teenagers. They don't want to release any of the recovered pelicans yet until they know what's going on, so they're here for at least a couple of weeks. But Clutterbuck says brown pelicans are one of her favorite birds to rehab. She's hopeful.
They're so resilient. They come back from some horrible injuries. They come back from severe emaciation really, really well. Not all species do well in rehab. Pelicans are one that do exceptional. So no matter how many birds we have in care, I know that we're going to have a really good success rate with them just because of their resiliency overall.
For KCRW, I'm Susan Vallett.
Still ahead on Greater LA, a long dry winter, actually several of them in a row, means a long, restrictive summer. New water regulations are about to take effect. More on what they are, where they're being implemented, and how bad it can really get. All yours on the other side of this. It's KCRW's Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Water restrictions are set to take effect tomorrow, June 1st. If you live in many parts of Southern California, as the drought goes on, the Metropolitan Water District is hoping that some of these changes will vastly reduce water consumption, maybe even prevent a total ban on outdoor watering later in the summer. So, what are the restrictions, and who do they affect? To answer that, Ian James is here. Ian is a staff writer at the LA Times focusing on water, been writing a lot about this kind of stuff. Hi, Ian.
Hi.
The restrictions are going to affect a lot of people differently. So if you wouldn't mind just sort of run us through some of the most important guidelines for people who live. Well, let's start with the city of LA.
That's right. In the city of LA, the restrictions include twice a week watering, so no more than 2 days a week, and that includes the entire city.
This is according to street numbers, right? Like even numbers, 2 days, odd numbers, 2 days.
Exactly. So for addresses with odd numbers, watering is limited to Mondays and Fridays. And then for people with addresses that end in even numbers, watering is limited to Thursdays and Sundays.
All right. What about the other areas? Because LA County has a lot of different cities, Beverly Hills, Santa Monica. Are there other restrictions in place in other places?
Right. It depends where you live. For instance, areas that get their water from West Basin Municipal Water District is also 2 days a week, whereas parts of Ventura County are now going to 1 day a week watering. And the goal depends on the water supply situation of each water supply agency.
You mentioned Ventura County, the Las Virgenes Municipal Water District, and this serves places like Hidden Hills, Calabasas, Agoura Hills. They have the slightly different water restrictions. Pretty wealthy suburb of LA, right? Made famous by the Kardashians. Do we expect that there will be a lot of violators there? You know, people who want to keep that grass green.
I guess it's always possible. And a big question with a lot of these rules is how does enforcement work? I know some water districts are dedicating some of their staff to, you know, focusing more on enforcement and potentially issuing fines. So we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah. What about swimming pools? A lot of swimming pools in Southern California, Ian. Do water restrictions affect swimming pools, or at least new? Because a lot of that water has obviously been in the pool for a long time. But you got to top it out because there is evaporation. And then, of course, the new pools going in new homes.
Yeah, I think for the most part, the rules are focusing on where there are rules that relate to swimming pools. They involve putting a cover on a pool and having that be a way that, you know, prevents evaporation. There aren't any rules that I'm aware of at this point that are limiting the refilling of pools.
What about places that consume a lot of water, like golf courses? We see the golf courses. I mean, I know a lot of them use recycled water, or they say they do. Any restrictions there?
Yeah, I've been talking with various golf course managers, and they're also, the rules will depend on where they're located, whether it is a course that's part of a parks district where they may be able to reduce water use more in some other parks that aren't used quite as much. But bottom line is all these areas, golf courses will also have to reduce. It's just not exactly clear how much in each place. Some of them are actually talking with the water districts and trying to figure out what they will be required to do and from what baseline. But in all these areas, golf courses will be affected. So talking to some course managers, they're talking about leaving some of the non-playable areas, letting them brown up as they reach the goal that's been set for them.
What about car washes, which we'll talk about in just a moment with our next guest? But car washes, you know, use a lot of water, but some of that's recycled as well, right?
That's right. And in general, washing at home uses a lot more than going to a car wash. So I think, you know, some of the rules throughout California focus on if people are going to wash a car at home, they're supposed to be using a shutoff nozzle so the hose isn't just running into the gutter.
What's been the response, Ian, so far to the drought? I mean, it seems like a lot of folks are just going about business as usual, right? I mean, December was wet, but then the rest of the water year has just been bone dry. How much does that worry state officials, water officials?
Well, I think the people who manage the state's water supplies are really concerned about where things stand with the low reservoir levels. I mean, the major reservoirs are at about half of their historic average right now, and this is heading into summer, so it's going to be a difficult summer to get through, and that's where these water restrictions are focused on, is trying to get through the summer without having more substantial cutbacks. But also the Metropolitan Water District has said that if this doesn't work out, if some areas don't reduce water use enough, and if they need to later on in the fall, it is an option to go to a complete ban on outdoor watering.
That is an option. And they've taken that option before, by the way. I mean, we've had droughts like this before. And Californians, by the way, have stepped up before, right?
Yeah, during the last drought. And it worked a little bit differently the last drought. You know, there were mandatory water restrictions for a portion of that time. And the state got very close to the 25% reduction goal. And a lot of those gains in conservation with people switching out, you know, lawns for native plants and things like that have held. So it's a bit different this time because there are bigger cuts that are being required across a large portion of the Metropolitan Water District service area.
Again, things that we're going to talk about here in just a moment about conservation and what you can do. But I want to thank you for coming on. Ian James, reporter focusing on water here in the West for the LA Times. Ian, thanks.
Thank you.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Well, even with all these new restrictions, there's still plenty that you can do at home that can make a difference and help conserve water. Even the smallest changes in the day-to-day can save a lot more water than you might think. And here to tell us more is Rita Kompeloth, Sustainability Program Director for LA County's Chief Sustainability Office. Hey, Rita.
Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Let's run through some of these basics that we all do, showering and brushing your teeth. What's the optimal shower time, for example, to get clean and to save the most water?
Yeah, I mean, I think 5-minute showers are great, and that probably still leaves a room for a lot of us to improve, too. So, like you said, yeah, lots of things that we can do in our daily lives.
It's funny, Rita, because you hear about when you brush your teeth, don't have the tap go. Of course, it's like a common sense thing, right? Don't have your tap going while you brush your teeth. How much water do you actually save by doing that?
Well, you know, I think that you can save several gallons of water. And the thing is with water conservation, as with a lot of other sustainability issues, it's those individual actions really add up. So, you know, it may not seem like a lot, but if everybody starts to take advantage of those practices and really make them everyday habits, it can actually add up over time.
Well, on that note, Rita, I mean, are there things that you can do, you know, small things that you can do on the day-to-day that really make a big difference? I know this collective, when you do something and millions of other people do something, then you can really make a big difference. And I'm wondering, you know, what is it that you can do in the bathroom or, you know, in your day-to-day while you're cooking in the kitchen or whatever, when you use water that can really save it?
Yeah, there are a whole host of things. We've been talking a lot about indoor water use, but of course, you know, well over half of our water usage is outside, right? So one of the biggest things that we can do is just, you know, rethink what our turf and landscape looks like. And of course, there's a lot of support from agencies to switch out your grass and switch to native drought-tolerant landscaping. I think one of the things we need to do is to start hardwiring some of that conservation into our lives and into our region, really, so that it's not always about sort of switching our behavior when there's a drought emergency, but, you know, it's sort of already ingrained into our way of life. You know, when you're turning off the water, like you said, catching that shower water, scraping your plate instead of rinsing everything. But I think one of the interesting things that we don't always think about is that it's not just about our water use in our house, but we can start thinking about our water footprint overall. So, you know, we use water for drinking and washing, but there's also a lot of water that goes into the food we eat and the products that we use and energy. So just focusing on food, things like trying to eat less meat, eating locally, you know, wasting less food. So buy what you need. All of those things can go into and really help us conserve water overall.
What about washing your car? That's another kind of sticky point, right? Like you shouldn't, I would imagine you shouldn't wash your car now that these restrictions, is there a restriction against it, by the way, or can you still wash your car?
You can wash your car, although I think you'll be restricted to maybe, I'm not sure what it is of late, but I know even before it was like a week, once a week maybe. But, you know, you can also, if you really must wash your car, a lot of commercial car washes actually reuse the water that they use. They recycle it. So that's a good option rather than just, you know, hosing your own car down and letting that water again run off into the stormwater drain where it just goes out to the ocean again.
A lot of folks planted gardens during the pandemic, right? How do you, you know, keep that garden going if you're limited on watering? I mean, you're trying to keep the garden thriving, right? But you're only allowed to water a couple times a week. Is that sustainable?
Yeah, absolutely. I was one of those people who planted a garden, and it was a great thing to do with the kids too. So, I hope people don't let those gardens die. You can still hand water. A lot of the restrictions will be around sprinkler systems and things like that. So, we do want to make sure that people are keeping that vegetation alive, and especially trees as well. You know, we want to make sure that even as we're conserving water and cutting down water use, we're not doing it at the expense of our important vegetation and trees that, help keep our city cool. So that would kind of be a little bit cross purposes if we were to do that.
What about, Rita, taking advantage of California offering these rebates, like rebate programs for some appliances? If you know, because I see these sometimes on my DWP bill or whatever it may be, and it's like, hey, if you do this high water efficiency appliance, we'll give you such and such money back. The state's offering some of those, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's some great resources that people can look to for that. So the county of Los Angeles has a website called waterforla.com. Also, Metropolitan Water District, which is one of our huge water providers here in LA, has socalwatersmart.com, where you can just go on there and find out what kind of rebates you can qualify for. Yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of resources for, as you said, washing machines, toilets, irrigation controls, and rain barrels and things like that.
Before you let us go, Rita, if you were to implement one thing, right, one thing to conserve water right now, what would it be? What's the biggest bang for your buck?
I think one of the things that I would do, going back to the idea of just, really rethinking what our city looks like, is to do much more of those switches away from turf and to native plants, which are beautiful and provide a lot of different ecosystem services, not just water conservation. If I could really change the way that our region looks, with, more permeable surfaces and less grass, I think that's what I would use my magic wand for.
Well, thank you, Rita, for coming on and talking to us. Rita Kompoloth, Sustainability Program Director for LA County's Chief Sustainability Office. Rita, as always, nice to have you on.
Thanks so much, Steve.
That's going to do it for us this evening. Tomorrow, LA Phil Music Director and Maestro Gustavo Dudamel talks about resistance, power to the people, as a theme in music and his orchestra's home at the Hollywood Bowl as well. He's going to join us on the show tomorrow on Greater LA. Online anytime, by the way, at kcrw.com/GLA. Share your thoughts with us. Send us some story ideas. At the very least, you can subscribe to the podcast and get it on the regular at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Juliana Mayo, Rebecca Ludman, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Tom, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl all made this evening's show happen. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ears. Have a great night.